This is the current federal tax developments for the week of May the 13th, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. Dollars, and we're coming to you again from Phoenix here to talk to you a little bit about what's been going on in the area of federal taxes. And in this week, we're going to look at comments the IRS gave at the ABA's tax section conference that recently took place regarding the final results for the ERC voluntary disclosure program, and discusses the future of what's going to go on there with CID in this program and other issues moving forward. We'll also take a look at an Eighth Circuit case where the taxpayer lost their research credit, and this was on appeal from the tax court, who had decided the same thing, because the court determined that their payment was not contingent on the success of research, so they had a funded research contract which could not qualify for the research credit. Next up, we have a press release from the Department of Justice, which announced the results of a court case in Missouri that resulted in a CPA firm being barred from promoting a FRAT single premium annuity tax shelter that we've discussed here before, and which the IRS is looking to make a listed transaction. So even though we have that movement, we knew they didn't like it. We knew that they were moving for listed transaction status. Turns out they were already taking action against certain people. And as we'll discuss in this particular situation, we had this particular CPA firm along with five others. We don't know any details about those five right away. Who were basically had suit filed against them. Five of them agreed effectively to have an injunction, to agree to an injunction against them. This one decided to fight, and we'll talk about what the court found, and basically, at least from the DOJ's perspective, and a little bit of discussion about that whole shelter. And of course, this makes it pretty clear that at least in some parts of the country, the IRS and the Department of Justice are moving against those promoting such a shelter. And finally, there was an announcement this week from, it's issued both under standard IRS letterhead, standard IRS news release, but also from the Office of Professional Responsibility relating to situations where a CPA or EAs or attorneys CAF number gets put under review status and effectively is suspended. We'll talk about how that happens, what you'll have to do if that happens, and the problem, which obviously is, while it is in that suspended status, you won't be able to do anything, and it's not necessarily something that you're going to be able to totally control. Talk about the problems and the issues. We'll also talk about a similar change, a similar issue. Both of these relate to the IRS trying to ensure that they aren't giving out taxpayer information to basically crooks that have stole the identity of a tax pro. There are also going to be significant changes to any practitioner that's requesting transcripts over the phone. We'll talk about how you have to go through the practitioner priorities line to get it. And we'll also talk about the fact that it's going to be delivered to your secure mailbox, or alternatively, if you can't get all that put together, it'll end up just being mailed to the client. And probably don't like this option too, because clients invariably don't pay attention to what gets mailed to them. Some don't, and so that transcript never comes back to us. So that could be a bit of fun. So we'll talk about that as well. So let's start and talk about the update was given on the Employee Retention Tax Credit Voluntary Disclosure Program. And this is from an article from Nathan Richmond, and he was reporting from the ABA Section of Taxation meeting. Natalia's article is ABA Section of Taxation Meeting, Incorrect ERC Claims Grow to $1 Billion in Voluntary Disclosure Programs. This was published in Tax Notes Today Federal on May the 7th of 2024. Speaking at the ABA Section of Taxation Meeting was Carol Schenck, the IRS National Fraud Counsel, and she was giving details on the Voluntary ERC Disclosure Program. Most of us remember that program. You know, it's the one where for a three-month period, taxpayers had the right to come forward voluntarily if they had received payment under the program. They agreed to pay back 80% of what they had received. They would not be charged interest. They would not be charged penalties. But they had to, you know, but it was all or nothing for each quarter. You couldn't change a claim. You could only basically say, yep, all wrong. We're sending it all back. Interesting program, had some problems and some quirks, but it was useful. And what she said was, and this makes it look, still, this is a drop in the bucket compared to the entire payouts that came out of the program, which were way higher than Congress had budgeted for. Suggesting there are a lot of people getting this that Congress didn't think were going to be getting this, or didn't think should get it. That's a different issue. So we have over $1 billion, though, now in the voluntary disclosure filings. So that means where people have agreed to return funds to the government. And that's up from the $225 million in funds that have been involved that was announced by the IRS on the last day of the program, when it ended on March 22nd. And you might say, well, that's, you know, why is the number so different? Well, the big difference here was that they had a huge number of submissions in the very last week of the program. And they are just now catching up and getting those basically counted toward the total amount of money that came in. So we're up to $1 billion. Now, presumably, though the article doesn't say for sure, but it appears that we should be close to, that's the number, that's what we've got. So $1 billion in there. So interesting problem, interesting issue. Now, again, under this program, taxpayers could retain 20% of their claimed credit. The justification for that from the IRS was that a lot of these people had paid third-party promoters, you know, who are out there saying, hey, everybody qualifies for ERC, apply for it, right? And I think we all know of cases where there were people pushing that weren't really asking much of anything, or at least not anything relevant, and were just, you know, going forward and filing these as quickly as they could, right? We all saw those types of situations where clearly nobody had actually checked to see what could happen. I have known of some very abusive situations that I was made aware of where it's like, well, either the people promoting this are wildly incompetent, or they just don't care because they're just doing a money grab as fast as they can and probably already have their method to get out of the country put together. So it was a weird thing. Now, I mean, it all sounded good up to a certain point. You got to keep that 20%. So if you had paid a 20% fee, you essentially, you know, you didn't lose anything you hadn't, you know, you basically didn't have before. And again, no interest, no penalties. You didn't have to repay the interest they paid you when they finally processed the refund. So it was all good. Now, as we all know, the practical problem for a lot of clients was they would have spent that money. So it's not as if they had that, you know, $800,000 sitting in a bank account somewhere. So that was a real practical problem, but that's not one the service has much sympathy for. The idea is you didn't deserve this. You really, you know, you probably didn't do the diligence we'd have preferred you would have done to figure out you didn't deserve it. So we're not going to really whine much about the fact that, no, you don't get to keep anything you shouldn't have gotten. But we will let you, you know, keep the 20%. So you could have also made something off that, especially if you hadn't paid in that form when you went in. And you just wanted out of the program because it is a complication. You know, I've been involved in some due diligence work recently, for clients where somebody comes in and says, I want to buy your company. And so you hire an outside firm to come in and ask questions. And they're being asked all the time about the ERC, right? Do you have ERC claims in process? Now, none have. Do you have any ERC claims in process? Did you file for it? Or did you file for any other, you know, CARES Act relief during the period? And, you know, the clear implication is if you did, this is going to complicate this whole issue of, you know, the acquisition of your company or your business or your line or whatever is being sold, right? We're going to have more of a problem. So yeah, definitely an issue. And so there are reasons like that, that somebody might just prefer to have gone down this path, get out of this, and, you know, for a sure number, and take that off the table, or at least take it to a limited amount on the table. The big problem with the program was, though, which I know attorneys I talked to were not happy with, is if you went into this program, there was no assurance you would not be criminally prosecuted. So they're still going to review, and if it appears you knew you didn't qualify, but you applied for it anyway, and you went out and bought a nice Lamborghini, you might still find yourself in front of the U.S. District Court staring at a jury. That's still possible. Other things you had to do was you did have to basically turn in everybody who had worked with you on the claim, any advisor that had been involved in the claim. That's always, obviously, part of this was to uncover a list of advisors, which now can be referred over to CID and other places to see if there are people we want to prosecute. So that was part of the program, right? So that was there. Now, they have continued to receive general voluntary disclosure filings following into the program. There are some generic voluntary disclosure options you can use with the service. There are different ways to do it. In fact, some attorneys were considering doing that under ERC, not using the main program, because if you did a separate one where attorney contacts the IRS on behalf of the client, they could negotiate a deal that, you know, you would do X, Y, you'd pay back X, Y, and Z, you'd disclose certain things, but they would also negotiate a, basically, they will not be criminally prosecuted agreement as part of it. So that was an interesting discussion. And I think because of some of those discussions, it really became interesting in how the program ran. Now, there are no current plans to reopen the program. However, if they do reopen it, she made it very clear that the terms are going to be less generous. So you probably won't get to keep the 20%, let's say, or at least you will have to pay interest on this. And maybe you'll get to keep something, but it won't be 20%. It'll be lower. You may end up with interest. You may have to pay a specified dollar amount penalty or percentage penalty. It could be different what you would owe otherwise, but you know, there could be various things here. They never give you a better deal if you wait. They know that if they ever do that, then that means every program they do, people will be waiting for the next program, right? They figure, I'm not going to go now. I'm going to go get a better deal later. So yeah, they intentionally ramp down. The best offer comes up front. As I said, not a perfect offer because we have this little problem that, you know, there are a lot, you know, there basically are issues even here. As I said, the client may have trouble getting the cash, and the client may not be comfortable with not being off the hook criminally. I mean, that's not a minor detail. And clients worry about things like that, often in cases where they shouldn't, but they worry about things like that. And as a professional, I need to tell them that, you don't get criminal waiver. So, I can discuss generically what tends to get you in criminal trouble, but I'll say, I don't know what you did. And I don't want to know what you did because I have no privilege, right? Anything you tell me, you could essentially be telling direct to the IRS, because even though I won't go talk to them, about this and turn you in, they can definitely haul me in, get a subpoena, haul me in, get a court order on the stand, and I have to testify to what you told me. So tell this to the attorney first to see if it's okay to tell me. Always something I would remind them if you have any concern whatsoever. I also told people back when this was open, and even now if something comes up, the minute you get the least inkling they might be about to tell you something that could be viewed in a criminal, that could be viewed as a way to open up a criminal case, you really got to tell them to go talk to an attorney and shut up if you're not a licensed attorney, right? Keep that in mind. Clients, the problem is people who get nervous love to confess. And you cannot be the person to hear their confession. Sorry about that. I can't hear your confession because I don't have any privilege. We need to get you somebody who does. Next up, we have the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals case of Meyer, Borgman, and Johnson, Inc., structural engineering firm versus commission. This came from the Eighth Circuit, docket 23-1523, and the Eighth Circuit decision was published on May the 6th of 2024. Now, this taxpayer had been under exam The IRS had denied their research credit claim. And the taxpayer went to tax court, where they lost in tax court as well. And the big matter of dispute was that the IRS and the tax court concluded that under the definition found at IRC section 41D4H, this was what's called funded research. So conceptually, what does this mean? Funded research is where you are hired and you perform some sort of research on the project, right? So you're doing something that maybe qualifies as eligible research under the research credit. But if you are essentially, in the simplest case, I'm going to pay you $100,000, you know, to determine if this could or couldn't work. But you get $100,000 whether you determine that that's fine, the research worked, or you determine that it's a failure. The experiment indicates, sorry, not going to work. So, I mean, I get the $100,000 either way, whether it produces something we can use or it doesn't produce something can be used commercially, right? So the question was whether the contract that this firm had was actually funded research or unfunded research. And this looks a lot at risk issues. For instance, and in this case, this will be the key issue. If in fact you don't get paid unless the research comes out favorably, right, then you have the risk. You're carrying all the risk. And they're trying to give this credit to the party that has the risk, not somebody who's insulated from it, right, who doesn't bear the risk and the problem. They're insulated from risk, then they're fine. And so the question is, were they? Now, again, and that was basically, you're going to be paid. It didn't have to work out. There are some other ways through. For instance, if you get to hold on to the intellectual property, you can use it otherwise. There are some assumptions there that effectively, if somebody hires you, but you're able to use this, whatever you develop, to like sell it to other people, because you've now developed this technique, if you have that right, they probably paid you way less than they would have paid if they got all the intellectual property rights, and more importantly, kept you from going to their competitors, who effectively then could be told about this. You could use this for their competitors, which they would probably prefer you didn't. Okay. Now, to be allowed a credit, the regulations require that the payment for research is contingent on the success of the research. In this case, the rights didn't stay with these guys. There was no other way. It had to be found that they would not be paid unless the research was successful. And so we start fighting over the terms of the contract. What did the contract say? And does that provide for a payment that is contingent on the success of the research? Now, the taxpayers in this case, their contract required the firm create a design that met the following criteria, right? So they're, you know, a structural engineering firm. They're trying to create a design and a method here to get this particular project done. And that design had to include all items the owner required, okay? It had to comply with all the pertinent codes and regulations. Yeah, it can't be illegal to build. That'd be helpful. It would result in a structurally sound building without being so over-engineered as to compromise the construction budget. So it's got to be cost-effective, right? Your design has to be cost-effective, not one that, yeah, it's just never going to work, right? You know, we don't want to, as I said, we don't want to over-engineer the project in such a way that it's going to be more costly than it should be. So, yeah, you know, you can't build something. It's only going to have one, like a bridge with one person whoever crosses it, that it's been engineered so it could carry, you know, 72, you know, big trucks to go over it at the same instant over this little bridge over a creek, which we'll try to finish them all, put them all on there. That'd be kind of over-engineered, right? Doesn't need to meet that criteria, right? That would be there. It has to be sufficiently detailed that a contractor could follow it, successfully construct it. Yeah, you know, you can't give me something I can't get anybody to build. They can't figure out what you mean. You got to be able to communicate to people. Okay, that's in the contract. You know, and the taxpayer argues that those requirements made the payment contingent on the success of the research. Now, the IRS and the tax court disagreed, and so did the Eighth Circuit. The problem here is those particular conditions are probably found in every single contract that this, you know, this engineering firm has ever entered into with regard to a building, right? Those would seem like wildly standard terms you would see in every contract. And what they're saying is the problem is none of those conditions were specifically tied to the success of any particular research they were doing, right? Now, you might, you know, obviously the engineering company is arguing that, wait, you know, if we had this research issue we need to deal with, and if that couldn't be handled successfully, then there's no way we'd comply with the conditions. You know, in essence, we'd violate one of those conditions. We wouldn't provide what the customer wants. You know, it wouldn't be, it wouldn't meet code and standards. It would be, it had to be wildly over-engineered and be too costly, so it's not cost-effective, et cetera. But the court said that that's not good enough. The taxpayer quoted, eventually referenced back to a case called Fairchild Industries versus United States from 1996 in the Federal Circuit. But the Court of Appeals noted in their opinion that there were very, very, very specific items of research work to be done. And if they failed those, then yeah, they didn't get paid. If they couldn't successfully solve those problems, you know, in that manner, the experimental problems, then basically, tough luck. They weren't going to get paid. You know, in this case, that was not there. This was just very, very standard, you know, general economic risk of investing resources type conditions. You know, it's similar to the fact, you know, when we as tax preparers take on engagement, if we don't actually finish the engagement, right, you know, and we don't have some condition in the contract that says, you know, we're able to get paid or we can get out otherwise, and or let's say we just discover, you know what, we're in over our heads. Yeah, you know, there's always that risk of having to withdrawing or leaving and not getting paid. But that's, you know, that's not what's at risk here. This is just a very general standard routine, standard contract that is too standard, right? It doesn't mean maybe there wasn't research or there may have been. But arguably they're going to say that, you know, it has to be spelled out in a contract like this. You can't just take your generic kind of contract that's basically the same as it's always been used, that has these same generic conditions that you'd use with a building that presents no special problems whatsoever, and have it somehow cover these other cases, at least per the Eighth Circuit and the tax court. So interesting case on research credit. At least it's better than the last one we covered where they had no records whatsoever. That's not a problem here. The problem here is they had funded research. At least that'd be at least one of the problems, because obviously the IRS could have argued otherwise, other issues, but they, you know, that wasn't what was in effect here. So that one's involved in that background. Next up, Department of Justice had issued this week a news release on press release on May the 6th, 2024. It's entitled Court Permanently Bars Missouri CPA from Promoting a Charitable Remainder Annuity Trust Scheme. Now, this is talking about a marketed tax shelter structure. It was kind of being sold to CPA firms and law firms, at least per the IRS discussions earlier, as a tax shelter in a box, right? There was a way to get this done. It, as often these shelters in a box do, they seem to involve insurance policies. So the party who puts this together is normally, you know, it may very well be the party that's getting the premium on the insurance policy, or not the premium, but the commission on the policy funded. And the insurance company may not have any idea that this is what's going on, because these people are just buying single premium annuities. So in any way, you know, it's tax shelter in a box, shall we say, kind of marketed to CPAs, attorneys, and the like. The IRS specifically said they had found it marketed to attorneys, CPAs, and EAs in guidance they gave at the beginning when they started criticizing this program. And we covered that, I think, a few years ago. I think it was even back in 2020, the first statements we got about this. What you do for this program, let's talk about this. we create a charitable remainder annuity trust. Okay. If you've ever done those, you know, there are basically two types of charitable remainder trusts. A charitable remainder annuity trust, which somebody puts assets, it can be cash, into a trust. That trust provides that for a period of years or for life, they will pay a fixed percentage of what was put in to the person that funded the trust. When that person dies or when the time period for payment ends, whatever remains in the trust will transfer to a charity, right? So it becomes a charitable contribution that, based on the various discount factors and calculations that determine what will be the, in essence, what is the principal interest and the income interest in the, let's say, $1 million worth of value that was transferred into it. And that principal interest, the interest that will go to the charity, presumably, is what you get as a tax deduction. That's not what primarily what they're going after here, but probably it's not a bad side effect, I'm going to assume. Now, you then donate appreciated property to the CRAT. The CRAT is treated as if it is at least partially a charitable organization. And just like any other when donation of appreciated long-term capital gain property to a charity, the taxpayer recognizes no gain, at least not directly. We'll get to how this works later. But so let's say I've got this piece of property. Maybe I've got, you know, the stock of my closely held company. And I got this buyer coming in. You know, and I founded the company back in 1978, and I put $200 in it. And obviously, in the interim, the value of the company now has grown dramatically. So the guy is coming in the door, you know, want to pay me $40 million. So $100, $40 million, I got a pretty big capital gain. So if I donate to the CRAT, and we also have to watch and make sure the sale's not a done deal before it goes in the CRAT. There's all kinds of planning here. We're not going to worry much about that here. Let's just assume that's fine. It goes to the CRAT. The CRAT then gives the stock to the buyer and receives the $40 million. Now, it does not pay tax on that either. So far, so good. We haven't paid tax on this big capital gain. However, under charitable remainder trust rules, what happens is that becomes this layer of income that we keep track of, historical layers of income we keep track of in the CRAT. And there's a reason we do that, because the annuity payments coming out of the CRAT are basically treated as coming out of these layers of what would have been taxable income that tax has not been paid on, right? So, you know, presumably with that, you know, $40 million sales price, $100 basis, there's very, very little funds in there that will not either be, you know, the capital gain, which will take quite a while to exhaust probably, but then also earnings on that later that allow the thing to, you know, basically continue to be funded. So there's probably going to be taxable income if you have that huge gain, or either the vast majority of, you know, that to pick it up as taxable income, the vast majority of the life or all of the life, pretty much everything they get out is going to be considered taxable. But they get to defer that payment to that extent. And remember, a good chunk of it we never pick up and in fact got a charitable deduction for. So there'd still be an advantage. But that's not what these guys are doing. What I've described so far is totally legitimate, right? Not a problem whatsoever. However, I mean, there are ways to foul it up, let's be honest, but totally legitimate. Now they will sell the asset and buy an annuity. That's also can be done. We can decide, you know what? I need to pay this annuity payment out to this guy for this period. So why don't we buy some sort of single premium? Why don't we buy some sort of annuity, at least annuitize part of it enough to, you know, pay out the whatever return I want. But in this case, you're going to buy an annuity that's with all the funds. All the funds are going to go buy this annuity. And this annuity will be, you know, we'll buy this annuity, and now's when the fun comes. What they claim happens at this point is, they're going to claim, and there are two ways they could argue this. Claim number one is that, which they say is, well, no, see, when you give it to the CRAT, that gift and triggers a increase in basis, right? A basis increase. So that now your basis in the property, the basis in the property to the CRAT becomes equal to what it was given, what it was worth when it was given. And there's really nothing they ever that explains why that happens. They just say it does. And then, but then secondly, and this is a little more still flaky as can be, but a little more, at least a little more plausible, is no, we buy the annuity, right? We buy the annuity. It's payable to you for the payment period for the payments to come out. And what's going to happen is, you know, so it'll be an annuity structured in some way that it pays, you know, certain amount, you know, for life, which should be equal to whatever the annuity contract said. And then what the setup with the CRAT said, I should say. And then the remainder would go at the end of that period or at your death, whatever remaining value there is, would go to the charity. So we do it that way. But what they say is we're just going to take the 1099-R issued by the insurance company. And remember, the insurance company is going to give you what they're going to say is, well, your basis in the annuity is, you know, the dollar value, right? So you paid $40 million for this. That's your base in the policy. They're only going to tax you on what's considered effectively the interest portion that's being paid out to you by the annuity during the year, not the amount that went into the principal. And so, and principal is overwhelming chunk of what's there. So essentially, you don't pay a whole lot of tax on this because, again, it's an immediate annuity. You buy it right away. And so because of that, they say, well, only the 1099-R amount shown as taxable is what you pay tax on, and we never pay tax on the capital gain. Now, again, they don't explain why an annuity owned by the trust would somehow instead, though, be taxed to the individual. It's, yeah, believe me, it falls apart terribly. And in addition to that IRS case that we had, we've had court cases that where this is lost. And we've also had the IRS moving to make this into a listed transaction. So there's our background, right? It is currently in a proposed regulations that would make this a listed transaction. But again, listed transaction doesn't mean it doesn't work. So in any event, court cases, the court, we actually go to court, lose in court. That pretty much means, yeah, it doesn't work. But what's interesting here is the government is already moving against the program. And this is a case, at least in the Missouri area, you know, in Missouri, they seem to be moving against the program, right? So, as I said, this program is promoted to tax advisors and, you know, tax advisors, so attorneys, CPAs, EAs. And, you know, it's like, as I said, it's tax shelter in a box. You go ahead and you sell this as your program, right? You have this wonderful deal. They do this. The only rule is you have to basically buy through us the insurance policy to make sure that everything's, you know, to make sure that we get our premium, you know, and so we go down that line. Well, turns out that they at least investigated in the Missouri area, right? So we have that. They sued this firm and five other defendants. So there are basically six that were involved, right? The other five agreed to the entry of permanent injunction by the court, but one firm decided to take their chances by going to trial. So again, DOJ offered a deal to the others. You know, it could have been a simple go forth and sin no more option. We won't promote it. We won't agree. You know, we won't basically concede that we did anything wrong, but we will agree not to do this, and we may agree to do some sort of fine. Okay. But that's it. So we're fine. So those five got in there. A lot of it depends upon how solid each case was, and whether and if their counsel advised them you're just going to lose on this thing. So yeah, I know DOJ is conceding virtually nothing, but all you're going to do if you go to court is spend more money on me, and they'll have the same result because you're not getting a good result in this case. You know. So all we're talking about is, do you want to pay me extra legal fees? I'm sure the attorney would say I'm all for it, but. Whatever. So anyway, but this firm decided to go to court. And based on the facts of the case, the firm lost and court imposed the following basically penalties. First thing is they barred them from organizing, promoting, selling, or marketing tax schemes involving the use of a charitable remainder annuity trust. Doesn't say just CRATs that are this program, right? It is very broad. They cannot do so. Apparently, they if this is as broad as DOJ suggests, you could literally be barred from doing, you know, any sort of tax planning using CRATs. Because, you know, it's not really just specifying certain subsets or certain details. It's basically very broadly because, of course, the court and DOJ is going to say, look, if you let them back out, they're going to find a way to try to maliciously comply with your order, which means try to read it as narrowly as possible and go out there and do something as close to this as they can without being this, but effectively is virtually the same thing. Malicious compliance, right? Of course, I don't usually like that, but it is a real pain because DOJ would have to investigate again, would have to again haul them back to court, and would have to, you know, spend money. So they're just barred flat out now. If they're marketing CRATs, DOJ can come back after them, right? And take them to court and said the barrier was you can't sell these things. So that's it. You were selling them. And also they had to disgorge the income. Well, I love DOJ says ill-gotten income, but we'll just say income. From the scheme of $400,000, that a payback effectively, which seems likely the gross fees they received for setting all of these up, and they have to stop doing it in the future. And remember, they still had to pay their attorney, right? We're still paying legal fees and all the time and effort and all the loss of billable time that takes place when you're down there defending a lawsuit like this. So I would say, yeah, lost. Probably lost. And you know, it would be interesting to take a look at. You have to go back and recheck the release, see if we can find out we're in those injunctions. But, you know, they may have been far better off, you know, unless this is less onerous than what the other parties agreed to in the injunction. They had probably been better off accepting the agreement before and at least getting out of the expense and the time of the trial. So it's there, but be aware. The IRS did go down. Now, it took a while and it's there, but they definitely came after such fees. And in the press releases, they kind of also mentioned, you know, that they're really looking here at, yeah, you know, conservation easements are they're interested in as shelters. And so that seems to be a warning shot that, hey, we're going to investigate there too. And we want to try to bring some of those cases. So we'll just see how all of that works out. Next up, and the final thing for this week we'll talk about, this is a news release from the IRS and an OPR alert from the Office of Fiscal Responsibility. And this deals with two issues. The OPR alert is entitled GAAP Numbers in Pending Review Status. It was issued on May the 8th, 2024. The IRS issued a news release, 2024-136, on the same day. It also discusses these pending review and suspended CAF numbers, along with changes to the transcript deliveries when a tax practitioner looks to request the delivery of a transcript by phone. There have been significant changes made to deal with concerns over ID theft from practitioners, from Circular 230 practitioners primarily here, right? That they're worried that they're accidentally allowing unauthorized persons to attempt to obtain confidential taxpayer information by posing as a representative by using a stolen CAF, right? So the idea is they somehow obtain your CAF number, and then they start filing 2848s in your name or information requests in your name. And what they're going to hope for is that they will then ask for these transcripts from the taxpayer's record. And those transcripts obviously will have a lot of details that could be very, very helpful to be used in defrauding taxpayers or identity theft. You know a lot of things about people that they wouldn't know how you would know because you've been handed their transcripts from the IRS. That would have details about their employers, where they have bank accounts, where they have brokerage accounts. It would be a lot of details in there, as well as their worth, their income. Yeah, there's all kinds of problems in that detail. Now, the Office of Professional Responsibility notice has this little thing like, you know, guys, you need to understand this. Your CAF must be considered personally identifiable information, and it's your effective responsibility, even though you're protecting yourself from ID theft, it's your responsibility to protect it. Because if that gets out, your CAF gets out and is in the wild. Now, the IRS was a little bit nicer about this and various other places. There are ways it's going to get out in the wild. There's no way around it. But it's there. So you should try to avoid it. And you probably should consider asking clients or others that get this information how they're going to protect that from disclosure. You know, how are you ensuring? You know, because we need to know, because now you've got my ID information and I want to make sure you don't disclose it. You don't lose it in some way, shape, or form. That'd be an interesting conversation with the client, but you know, we'll do what we can. Now, okay, the OPR also discusses the IRS's authentication process for those who claim to hold a CAF. You've probably all been through that, right? They're going to ask you some information that supposedly confirms that you are you, right? Who are you? What's there? There'll be various information they will request from you if you've called in to the IRS to do any sort of discussion about taxpayer issues. So they'll confirm that sort of thing. Now they're saying, here's where the changes begin. IRS employees now have a process to refer any CAF number that they see as potentially suspicious for further review. And these are paste in pending review status. Now, I suppose just in case somebody listening in here does not know what a CAF number is, centralized access file is what it stands for. And that's a number that is assigned to, you know, each Circular 230 practitioner the first time you file a form on behalf of a taxpayer that is treated as practice before the IRS, at least as the courts currently define it. So previously, I wouldn't have phrased it that way because the IRS would believe filing return was practice. Now they're not so sure. Now the courts say it's not. But this thing's like filing a power of attorney. You file a power of attorney the first time you do so as a CPA. You know, what happens is I fill in all the data. I don't have a CAF number. I leave that blank. The IRS will then start the process to issue me a CAF number. And then you're given that number, and that is your number for life, right? It is, or at least, well, we'll talk about when maybe it's not for life, but that's a different issue. Get there eventually. And that's the number you use. Well, in this case, if the IRS employees believe it's suspicious and, you know, the person they refer it to agrees that this looks weird, they're going to place it in pending review status, and they're going to suspend the CAF. And that suspension is your big problem. But you may be told that your CAF is pending review. That means you are on suspended status right now. The IRS cannot interact with anybody with a CAF that is pending review and suspended status until the matter is resolved. OPR says this is like a credit card hold. If Citibank believes that my credit card is being used illegally, Citibank will place a hold on the card, right? And they will not allow more charges to go through until the matter is resolved. So things like that. I had it happen years ago at a hotel. It was kind of funny. It wasn't checking in or things like that. It was later. This was a hotel that wanted to make money every way possible. So they had a printer, you know, a computer and printer, and you could print your boarding pass, but you were charged to print it. And it didn't just add on your hotel bill. You rather had to run this piddly little charge. You had to give like a credit card to do it. So I gave my credit card. Well, it turns out the company that did it was based in Canada. And that totally freaked out. I think it was Citibank's computer. And they went bonkers and locked the account. And, you know, I suddenly got texts and everything else from them. And so I called the number on the back of the card because I never call the number in the text because obviously you get fraudulent texts, but the number on the card, that's the number Citibank told me to call. So I'm going to, that's the number they said, you know, call in case of issues. They'll know about the fraud they did, and we walked through. And I discovered that, yeah, I had paid a company in Canada some piddling little number. And also the fact it was so small is also considered a potential fraud indicator, because small numbers are used to check to see if it'll clear, and they figure nobody's going to really complain about it initially. So then they'll run the big number later, right, at that time. So that's also why they worry about small charges. Weird structure like that. Now, they do note the risk of a third party obtaining access, and basically, which is true, for various legitimate reasons, you may give the client the 2848 with the CAF number on it. You may give a copy of it to them after it's been executed and signed by both of you. Legitimate reasons. You know, I don't know about you, but, you know, when you send a CAF to a client, when you send a 2848 to a client to be signed, right? Do you normally suppress the CAF number and only fill it in after it's sent back in? I think the, you know, OPR is suggesting that might not be a bad idea. And then you suppress it on other forms. But sometimes you might have to send it to a lender or somebody where we're trying to work something out, which case then, and they may demand to see it, right? To prove it's a real, to show a real forms in there. They want the form. So in any way, it might get out. And then it could be basically disclosed inadvertently by the client or that third party to someone else, potentially due to a data breach for that company, right? So they release that, and that's a potential problem. So there are ways that can happen that aren't just you selling it or your systems being infiltrated. As well, they note that trying to distinguish fraudulent activity from actual activity is difficult. And OPR in their notice says, there will be false positives under the program. Some people will get their CAF suspended when in fact nothing has really happened. Their account's not been compromised. There is no problem, but it got flagged because it had certain activity that internally looks suspicious. And the IRS's theory is the last thing they want to do is be found to be handing out client taxpayer data to all these people that had no authorization for it. So they're going to back off and do the opposite, exactly what they did. If your account is suspended, you will get a letter from the IRS. This will make you feel great. Probably from the Criminal Investigation Division, right? Noting your account is under investigation. Oh, welcome. Good morning, CPA, EA attorney. You're under investigation by the Criminal Division. That's a good letter to get, right? Yeah. So anyway, that will start. What they tell us is they do have some suggestions if this happens to expedite the process of being able to get back and actually do work where you need to have the authorizations in place. You know, you're asked to verify your identity by sending the IRS a notarized document that includes pictures of your photo identification. They want to make sure you get that done and get it back to them as quickly as possible. I find it interesting, though, the notary usually has to ask for ID. And it's like, well, wait, if this person supposedly has stolen ID, then we don't worry about that particular problem. That's a notary's problem. Notarized document should be returned, the CI using the mailbox provided in the letter within 30 days of the day of the letter. And mailbox, in this case, may very well mean the electronic mailbox. Online, within 30 days of the day of the letter. And then you'll begin a dialogue of verifying your client listings and, if needed, the issuance of a new CAF number. This dialogue may be done over the phone in some cases to accelerate the process. It means it may not be. So be aware of that, right? And I have a feeling there's not a simple way to speed this up. Hopefully you've got other people you work with who are qualified practitioners who could at least essentially take over the representation issue in terms of at least getting data in those cases while you're stuck with a false positive suspended account. If your number is confirmed to have been compromised, if we have found that there are people that use your old number, and I say old because it will become an old number, your old number to attempt to represent taxpayers, you're going to get a new CAF number. And probably, I'm going to bet, all of your current powers will be revoked. You'll have to go get any client for whom you have a power that's not yet been revoked, that is not one that now, oh, you know what? That's okay. Let's go ahead and just revoke that one. You'll have to go and get them to sign new powers and get them reprocessed, almost certainly, because my guess is that old CAF number will just be invalid, period, if it ever shows up. So it's there. Now, the other change they announced was a change to the practitioners who are requesting transcripts by phone. And they're going to limit this. You're going to have to call the practitioner priority service to initiate a request. Nobody else in the IRS will be able to get a transcript sent by mail to a practitioner, period. Everybody else is going to only be able to send them to the taxpayer. Now, we'll see how this works and we'll see how it all works out, but this is what they're saying. You must call PPS to initiate the request now. The transcripts will be delivered to your secure object depository mailbox, and that's in e-services is where you're going to find that. Going to e-services, you get it. For reasons I don't totally understand, it's not in your tax pros account. Just, yeah, you'll find a way to get it, so you'll be there. Other IRS lines, they make it very clear, other lines are not able to provide transcripts to practitioners. They can provide you with, quote, information over the phone. They can discuss matters, but they cannot actually send you the transcript. If you need to see the transcript, which we all know is really helpful, then yeah, and you're going and operating by phone, well, it's going to get messier. So what you'll do is you'll need to pass authorization and provide the short identification number associated with your secure mailbox. So we have that tied down. If you cannot authenticate, your ID cannot be verified, then the transcripts will be sent to the taxpayer's address of record. Again, that may not be the best result, but it's where it's going to go. So obviously, you know, a number of things here. First, this makes it even more important to attempt, if at all possible, for those who are covered by the program, which is mainly individuals at this point, but, you know, get your transcripts through the Tax Pros portal, have the client authorize online, and that way you can get these details without having to go through all the PPS stuff that's involved. So, you know, that's going to be way simpler and less of a problem. If you are one of those that have resisted from day one and you want to practice by phone, you can do it. But no, you're still going to have to get on the computer to get access to the transcript. It will not be mailed to you. It will be, at best, it'll be mailed to the client. You can go to the client. You can go to your secure online mailbox. It cannot go to your postal mailbox. That's not allowed at this point. Got to go to the secure mailbox or nothing. So again, they're not going to mail it out. And the theory being, I'm sure, is because of concerns that people may file address changes or other things back, you know, kind of quietly on the firm. And so these transcripts might get in the wrong hands. So they want you to be using an account that only you can access. You're not going to send it by mail. I wouldn't doubt also they might have had problems with rogue employees in some firms who have essentially, you know, grabbed anything in the mail that, you know, they figured out what a transcript looks like, and they just grab them and do something with them before sending them on to the person, which would probably be the smartest thing to do, or simply take them completely. But yeah, those are the problems that we see. So in any event, you know, there's not much you can do about the pending review suspension issue, except try to limit how much your CAF number gets out. With regard to the transcripts, just be aware the process is changed now. And because you did it that way for 30 years does not mean it works anymore, right? That doesn't matter. It is changing. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of May the 13th, 2024. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your State Society of CPAs. I hang out around on the Connect sites for the CPA societies in Arizona, New Jersey, Minnesota, Illinois, Washington, and Idaho. Also, my email address is edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We will be back with you next week. Don't forget those 990s and 990 extensions this week. Yeah, remember, May 15th is here. Hey, you got a date involved, so we have May 15th. So keep that in mind. We'll come back next week, though, and talk to you about anything that has changed in the area of current federal taxes.